It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimeras Comics. Chimeras is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimeras Comics. And now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Thank you. This is Caffeinated Comics. I am your host, John Clark. As you know, Wednesday was David Letterman's final show after 33 years, both on CBS and NBC. I watched the last show and I was surprised by how much I was affected by it, to the point where I really wanted to spend this show talking about what Dave meant for comedy and for Generation X and for me personally. And I wanted to get several perspectives on Dave. So the first person we're going to talk to is stand-up comedian Keith Alberstadt. Now, Keith is a New York comedian. He's originally from Nashville, but he's done Letterman twice, in 2009 and 2012. So first we're going to talk to him and get his perspective on what it's like to actually perform on The Late Show with David Letterman. And then after that, we're going to talk to our old friend Bill Monroe about what it was like to be in the audience and what it was like to watch him through the decades. I think they're two really great stories, and first, let's get to Keith.
2003, I met Eddie Brill, who at the time was booking The Late Show. Met him at the Boston Comedy Festival, and he saw my set, took a liking to me and my comedy, my sense of humor. I went to one of his seminar Q&A session things, and and we just kept in touch after that. Every 6 months, like literally to the day, I would always make myself a point to send him a new tape, and it kind of just started rolling. I didn't know how much momentum I had rolling. It was just kind of like every 6 months I got to send him something new. And then he saw me live at a showcase event in Nashville, which I thought was kind of ironic, because I moved from Nashville to New York to get opportunities like this, and I moved to New York and I get an opportunity like this, and it's in Nashville where I just moved from. But the showcase went great. It was a lot of fun. I didn't know it at the time, but that's when he pretty much made the decision that I was going to be on the show, but he didn't tell me that then.
But before you
and then
so that, before you did your Keith, before you did your set in Nashville, did you know Eddie Brill was there and watching, or was it just he was in the audience and you were just doing the set?
No, he was there all week doing shows, and then he instead of doing a show on Sunday, he just invited he had like an invitation only showcase for okay. comics throughout the Southeast. And even though I was no longer based in the Southeast, I'm from there, and so I got the club there told me about it, and so I was able to and he expressed an interest in wanting to see me live. That's the thing about tapes, man. You can send a tape and send a clip and all that all day long, but it's something about watching a performer live. You get such a better feel for what kind of comedy he or she is doing and what kind of sense of humor and style and personality and whatever. And so that's what tipped the scales. But again, I didn't know it at the time. And then fast forward a few months, and I knew he was doing some more of those type showcases in New York. And I just emailed him and said, hey, looking to see what kind of showcases you got coming up. I could possibly get on one of those lineups. I'd love for you to see me again live. And he emailed me back and said, I just had an opening. I'm going to put you on the show next week.
Wow.
And I didn't know if he meant, because I was just emailing about a showcase. So I didn't know if he meant the showcase part, like another live showcase, or the actual show. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
So I sat there and reread it, and sure enough, it was the show. So it kind of took me by surprise. It was only 1 week advance notice, so I had 1 week to. We already had the set pretty much. We just had to dwindle it down to 5 minutes. Right. We had like a 7 minute chunk that he liked, and we just had to basically figure out which 2 minutes weren't going to make the cut. And then I was in Washington, D.C., so I was at the Improv all that week, and I would start my set off every night with that 5 minutes to perfect it. And then we got it to where it was, where we wanted it to be. And then and I was on the show. That was it.
And how
was it? I told you it wasn't an extraordinary story, but the way that it kind of it just kind of flowed and meshed into this moment of it. And like, there was a little bit of confusion there. Like, I didn't know what show he was talking about, and kind of came out of left field with no, because I didn't know that I tipped the scales that live performance. I didn't know he was going to put me on the show at that point. So right. It's kind of a big surprise to me, a big pleasant surprise.
Now, how was that day? Walk us through the day of like of going to the Ed Sullivan Theater and knowing. Now, had you done TV before, Dave?
Or is this no? That was my national TV debut.
Wow. So how are you doing that whole day?
You mean the day of?
The day of, yeah.
It's hard to explain. I was so determined to not make that different than any other day. In order to not get it in my head, you know, not think too much about it. I wanted to, you know, do whatever I normally, it was on a Monday. We taped on a Monday, it was going to air on a Friday. And so, you know, whatever I do, I got back in town late Sunday night. It was Super Bowl weekend, by the way, so I watched the Super Bowl and fast forward for the first time in my life. First and only time, I should say. And then, so Monday was just I was determined to make it a normal day, you know. Ran some errands and, you know, returned some emails. I didn't tell anybody outside of my family that I was going to be on the show. I didn't want to, I guess, be bombarded and kind of get in my head about right. it. So, especially knowing that I had 4 days to kind of announce it, I wasn't in a hurry to tell anybody. So, just going about my business. And then I went in at 5 o'clock and taped, and it was kind of a blur. But that whole day, I was thinking about it, but in order to not get myself too crazy,
Yeah, so you were trying.
I just played the day as normal.
Yeah, so you're trying to basically just power through and not freak out about it. How much harder was it when you actually get to the Ed Sullivan Show and you're in the green room and you're standing on that stage?
Well, Eddie was great. Now, as soon as me and my manager got there, we did a walkthrough before the audience got in. And so we were able to kind of get a comfortable feel for what the place was going to look like and feel like where my mark was and whatever. So that helped tremendously. And Eddie was also very helpful in calming me down. I wasn't extremely nervous to begin with, which is very hard to explain. But he basically said, look, man, you deserve to be here. You worked hard. This is going to be a moment you'll never forget in your entire life. So just have fun with it and enjoy it. And so walking out on the stage, when he called me out, I looked over at Dave to kind of acknowledge, obviously my national TV debut is on David Letterman. I wanted to kind of acknowledge that. And what was funny is Dave wasn't even looking at me. he introduced me, and then he was kind of just looking down at whatever notes he had in front of him. And so I walked out, and I looked over expecting him to kind of be looking at me mm-hmm. in a introductory fashion. No, not the case. Which I kind of got a little chuckle out of, and then I hit my mark, and then just kind of just did it like I shouldn't say like a normal show, because obviously it's not. But I was just like Eddie said, just having fun with it and being in the moment. Right. And he was right. You know, you never forget that. I was fortunate enough to have two friends with me backstage, Tony and Carrie and Deo. They were great because they were on camera duty. So I was able to get a bunch of photos for the record. Mm-hmm. So it's a fun event, man. I mean, it was really an indescribable moment, but one I'll never forget.
When you were doing your set, were you tempted to look back over at Dave and see if he was listening during the set, or were you really focused on the camera or the audience that's in the Ed Sullivan Theater? Like, where was your focus for that 4 minutes?
Pretty much the audience. You know, nobody instructed me to, you know, to play to the camera mostly or play to the audience mostly or whoever. So I just went out there and played to the audience. I knew, of course, the camera was there, but I was just playing it like it was a comedy club. The one time I felt just a little tempted to play around was when I did a joke about Canada, and Canada is actually the punchline. And knowing that Paul Schaefer's from Canada, he's right there on the right. The band is right to your immediate right, just several feet away, but almost on top of you. So when I did the Canada joke, I was kind of tempted to look over and say something. But then I had this little voice in my head, don't mess this up. Let's just just say where we're at right now. Yeah,
and did you have much contact with Dave or Paul or the producers after your set, like after the show, or was it once it was wrapped up, did you have any downtime?
Say that again?
So after your set, was there any time to really unwind in the theater, or you just kind of did your set and you're out? Did you have any contact with Dave after your set?
Well, outside of the normal obligatory handshake after the set, that was it. Beirut, the band Beirut, was playing after me. So Dave came over, said, Keith Albersett, very nice. In fact, he said the word lovely. Lovely. that was it. And then he says, stay tuned, Beirut's coming back, or whatever he said. And right. For a commercial, I mean, he was gone. I mean, he shook my hand. Once we broke to a commercial, the band started playing. Mm-hmm. And then he walked back to his desk area. And that was it. I walked backstage, and it was kind of like the blur just ended. Like, the whole thing just kind of happened like a lightning flash. And it was, wow, this is over now, sort of a moment. And that's when it kind of hit me, that holy crap, man. Yeah. That was pretty cool. Yeah, that's how it happened.
And did anything change for you immediately after doing the show? As you said, it's your first national television exposure. Did your club dates start upgrading? Were you busier? Or is it business as usual going back?
Well, it was, you get that immediate recognition, which is what we're all striving for, I guess. You know, you want that that industry recognition as well as the fans. You know, it's a pretty big moment. It's a pretty big feather in the cap. So it affected, from a recognition standpoint, from clubs and whatever, that you finally got that big credit. Nothing earth-shattering changed. Doors didn't fly off the hinges like they did, I guess, back in the day.
Yeah, back in the day. I think
Carson and even the beginning part of Letterman, once that TV exposure hits, especially Carson, it's like your whole world changes. It's not like that anymore, unfortunately. But there still is respect there from peers, fans, and the industry alike. It just doesn't, doesn't turn your world upside down like it used to.
Right.
So yes and no to answer your question, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. And then you're back on 4 years later. Was there another showcase, or now that you were on Eddie's radar, it was a matter of finding a time to do it?
Yeah, it was just a matter of time. In fact, Eddie was still involved, but it was when the new bookers took over. Mm-hmm. And I just reached out to them and introduced myself, and they immediately, they went and watched my old set as well as some of my clips online, and they took a liking to me as well, and came out and saw me live at the Comedy Cellar, and we started working on the set after that. That was a little longer of a process, so which is good and bad. I kind of liked the way it happened with Eddie, because I didn't really have a whole lot of time to think too much about it and stress about what jokes go where and which jokes to use and whatnot. It kind of just happened. This one was probably a 2 to 3 month process, which had like mid-February through mid-April. So 2 month process. So to answer your question, it was no showcase. It was just kind of like just a familiarity thing. You know, I'd been on the show before, and they were just new to the booking game, and they're probably looking through archives or whatever, getting their feet wet. At the time, there had been a bunch of comedians that were getting on who had been on before. Mm-hmm. People like me and Ted Alexandro and Nick Griffin.
Yeah, I know Ted was I know Ted was like a 10-year break. It was like a really long break for him.
It was a long break. I don't know what they're thinking, because he's hilarious.
Yes, he is. We had him on last summer when he was starting Teacher's Lounge. Ted's amazing.
Oh, Ted's unbelievable. Yeah, he's just a brilliant comic. I love the way he writes and performs. Yeah. I love how Ted is so comfortable with silence. You know, he's on his own pace, and he commands so much respect and attention. He commands your attention when he's up there. So he basically, as soon as he steps foot on stage, he's in control. He's taking the audience at the pace he wants to go at, which I think is remarkable. But anyway, so that's how the second time happened. It's kind of like a familiarity thing, and so that was back in 2012.
Yeah, would you say you were more comfortable the second time, or was it because of that lead time that there were just more opportunities to get inside your own head?
There were more opportunities, but there are also more reasons to get inside my head. I was a little more nervous the second time around, which people warned me about. Ted warned me, Kathleen Madigan, she's one of my mentors over the years. She told me ahead of time. Nick Griffin said that, like, your second time is kind of that's the time where it starts to hit you that, wow, this is really happening. And so it did. So I thought a little too much about it. I got a little more nervous than my first time, but it was still just as much fun.
Yeah. And how did you feel about how the sets went? Were you happy with the response?
I was happy. I was thrilled with both sets, and trying like crazy to go on a third time before it was too late, and didn't get it to work.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting when Stephen Colbert starts, because it's not going to be the Colbert Report how often he's going to have stand-up segments.
Interesting. I mean, I want to know. I mean, I'm interested to see what happens. How's that landscape going to be? Because, yeah, he carved out a nice little niche for him on Comedy Central with that Colbert Report, which is different. I think he wants to maintain that unique flavor. Yeah. But if you have a late night show, it's almost like there's an obligation and an expectation to put on comics.
Right, and there's a formula to it. And obviously, he's not going to be doing political stuff anymore, and he's not going to be playing the character he was playing on the Colbert Report. So it's going to be a brand new show. So it'll be interesting to see if it's going to command the presence that Dave did all those years. You know, and how New York it's going to be, because he's going to take over that theater.
Yeah. Interesting to see, man. And I think a lot of stuff's being secretive. He's being secretive about a lot of stuff, I think. I haven't heard too much about what the show is going to be like, what it's going to look like, what the feel is.
Right.
I haven't heard anything.
Well, when I talked to Mike a couple of months ago, Mike Brum, on this show, and at that point they didn't know. And they said they were going to start work in April and try to figure it out. But before they started in April, they had no idea. Now it's only May. So who knows how much is even set in stone. We know that the Dave set is gone. That's all we really know.
Yeah.
You know? So Keith...
Well, when you know, you let me know when you know, John.
I will, and I'll put it on the show, and I will tag you. So Keith,
but it's definitely sad. It's definitely, I mean, watching that last show, holy crap, man, so many memories. I watched that show nightly through high school and a lot of college. It was so awesome.
Yeah, yeah, it really was. As we were saying right before we started recording, I haven't felt a change like this since Johnny left.
Yeah,
you know? And I was
it's gonna be interesting to see who the next torchbearer is gonna be,
right,
if there is one.
Yeah.
I mean, I got a lot of people are looking at Fallon as the next guy, but who knows? I mean, it could be Kimmel for all we know.
Yeah,
I guess time will tell. Really.
Yeah, and you have Conan's settled on basic cable, and how much of a presence is he going to command against these newcomers? Because he's going to be one of the oldest guys standing now that Jon Stewart's leaving.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. So, Keith, what's going on with you now? What's coming up?
I'm just knocking around the old comedy scene, doing spots here in New York and around the country. I've got can I plug some dates?
Yeah, this will run tonight. So you can plug stuff that's coming up really soon.
Oh, awesome. All right, I'm going to be in Kingston, Washington, actually, Wednesday night at the casino there. And Cheshire, Connecticut on Friday. I like to do my comedy bookings on opposite coasts in three-day intervals. That's how I like to book. I like to go from right outside of Seattle to Cheshire, Connecticut in 3 days' time.
So you like planes, is what you're saying.
It's ridiculous, man. It kind of just worked out like that. And now I'm looking at it like, this is ridiculous. It's insane. It's insane. This is why God gave us coffee, right?
That's true. How can we find
you? And then I'm in Williamsburg in the first weekend in June and Outer Banks, North Carolina, second weekend in June. My website is keithcomedy.com. I got all my social media links there, as well as the video clips from both my Letterman appearances as well as some other TV stuff and other video clips. So check it out.
See, wasn't that cool? Now we'll talk to Bill. You guys know Bill. We talk every few months on this show. And I wanted to talk to Bill because we're the same age and we grew up in a similar fashion of getting old enough to watch Dave when he was still new and then following him to CBS and really staying with him until just this week. So now here's a lengthier discussion all about Dave with Bill Monroe.
I remember the first episode I saw, it was either in like 84 or 85 in a hotel room on a family vacation after an episode of The Tonight Show with Joan Rivers.
Oh, when she was guest hosting for Johnny?
When she was guest hosting for Johnny. So, yeah, so it goes back to those that mid-80s time frame, and that was sort of, you know, obviously I was not really old enough to be staying up and watching it on a regular basis, or, you know, and eventually I could a little bit more when I had, like, a broken-down TV in my room and could, you know, sort of tune into Channel 4 at the time to get Letterman. But that's where it starts, and I got really interested in catching Letterman every time I could since then, and after that, they published a book in 1985 of, you know, the late show with David Letterman, and it was just bits from the show and quotes and monologues and things.
I
like
remember that book.
Fun. Yeah, I've still got it. I was flipping through it the other day, and it's like and one of the things that's interesting is looking at some of the monologue jokes and realizing that, yeah, they've been telling a lot of the same jokes over the years. They just swap in their different fat guy at different times. You know, now it's Chris Christie, back then it was Tip O'Neill.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you think that all presidents are basically the same jokes.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's like the president's either dumb or he's greedy.
Right.
You know, with Clinton, you just push greed a little over into lust.
Although
they did a lot of dumb Clinton, like, hick jokes.
Yep, and they also did a whole bunch of Clinton fat jokes.
They did. Clinton was really great for America.
He's really great for the comedians of America.
He was. He gave comedians a lot to do. There was a good economy.
Yeah, exactly. You know, when I look back at, you know, where I started with Letterman and where he ended up today, what I think is really one of the most interesting things about it is that today, when you talk to folks today, and Letterman is just like sort of one of the old stalwarts of late night TV and the cliche way of doing it, and it's just so much the industry. But when he got his start, the things he was doing then, and really a lot of those things he's still doing now, those were so different from anything else that was on TV at the time. When you look at the way he was just sort of playing with the medium, with doing things like in that old show of the late night thrill cam, where just a camera that came straight down the ceiling.
Well, that 12:30 show was a freak show.
It was.
It was like you had Chris Elliott under the stairs. And
I remember the man under the stairs. And I remember first time I saw that, I was young enough that I was still trying to figure out, okay, does that dude actually live on the stairs and they're just featuring him now, or is it just a homeless guy in the building? Or
yeah, my first encounter with Letterman was on New Year's, where I got to stay up, just like you were saying. We were at the age where when Letterman started, we were younger than 10.
Right.
So he was new, but we couldn't see. It was like Saturday Night Live. You get to an age where you're allowed to stay up to watch Saturday Night Live.
Right, you know, which is actually about 2 years after you started watching it.
Yeah, and that's when you'd start watching it regularly and start quoting it.
Right.
But I remember the first time I saw Letterman, it was on a New Year's, and my dad and I, it was about 1 in the morning at that point, And it was obviously a rerun because I don't Letterman didn't do a New Year's show, but we turned off a movie we were watching. Like we watched a VHS tape and it was just on and Pee-wee Herman was the guest. I'd never seen Pee-wee Herman before.
Uh-huh.
Because this is before Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
And sure.
He was doing breakdancing, which he does in Pee-wee's Big Adventure where he just smashes things. And that was the show. And Dave's like, uh-huh. And Dave is introducing this guy in a bow tie kicking Hummel figurines. And I was like, what the, what is going on at this time of night? Like, I wasn't awake. I was like, does this just happen all the time when kids go to sleep?
Right.
Like, weird guys in tight suits kick Hummel figurines.
And that's not even the strangest thing that was going on. I mean, he provided the perfect venue for Andy Kaufman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had a lot of, like, that avant-garde form of comedy. And you look at his jokes were always they were like Steve Martin in a way. They were deconstruction of normal jokes.
Right, right. Yeah, he wasn't telling the, you know, the same stuff you would hear elsewhere. He was again, you know, sort of making fun of the whole thing.
Yeah, and he was cool. I think the way I would describe it to millennials is that he was our Conan.
You know, I think in terms of playing with the medium standpoint
and just being cartoony and broad,
I think he was more of our Craig Ferguson.
Yeah, but he was more successful than Craig Ferguson.
He was, you know, he was more successful than Craig Ferguson. Well, I don't know if that's fair to say. I think Craig Ferguson had the success in 12:30 that Letterman had in 12:30, and I think Craig just, it wasn't what he wanted to do. I mean, after 10 years, he was just done on his own.
Yeah,
he didn't have the same desire to be the big late night guy that Dave was. And I think at that point too, the perception of the Tonight Show had changed as well. Where, you know, at that point when Letterman was coming up, it was, you know, the Tonight Show was still just such an icon, and Johnny was doing such amazing things there that how could you not want to ultimately do the Tonight Show? But as you get more into the late 80s and throughout the 90s with the late night wars, where all of a sudden there were all these other different venues popping up, and we see we watch how Conan got screwed, and I think when we look at, you know, at that, I think ultimately turned the whole thing around, where you've got Craig who's doing really amazing things in that show and ultimately just says, you know what, I'm done.
Yeah, and it's interesting how you bring up Carson, because Carson was the baby boomers late night guy, and obviously he didn't create the Tonight Show. Jack Parr had already done it. Steve Allen had already done it. But he was the boomers late night guy, and he had no competition until the 80s.
Right, exactly.
So if you were up that late, you were watching Johnny Carson, and it was a long show it was like at least two hours.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, it spent most of its time as an hour and a half before cutting down to an hour.
Yeah, and they would just leave everybody on the couch, and they would just have conversations. But I remember watching that.
And they smoking and drinking through the whole thing.
Oh, yeah. I remember watching that, and obviously you would see Carson earlier in your life than you would see Letterman, because you could stay up to midnight easier than you could stay up till 1.
Right.
But it was this feeling of, well, this is what show business is. I'm seeing show business. This is how it works. And you did not get that feeling with Letterman. Letterman was just some guy that was doing something.
Yes, exactly.
And, you know, I remember the late night show, the NBC show, it didn't even seem like the lights were all the way on. You know, like compared to the CBS show.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I mean, he had, we hear when Conan took over that show, when Letterman left, you hear a lot of that same thing. It's about there's no money being spent. The lights aren't on. You know, when Letterman made the move to CBS and to the Ed Sullivan Theater, that's when it became a show. I mean, that's really where, you know, the money that was involved in that show really took off.
Right. And that was CBS's first, well, not their first attempt. It was their first successful attempt.
First successful attempt. Exactly. Well, yeah, I think we could, I don't think they've had anything nearly as successful as that, nearly 30 year run.
Yeah, it was 20 years. Cause it was a good 10 on NBC, and it was the mid 90s. Cause I remember, Yeah, I remember graduating college when Dave moved over to CBS. Yeah, it was
1993 when when his show premiered on CBS.
Yeah, there you go.
1992, because I think I was living in the trailer park at that point.
Yeah, I was in college. I was in college by that point. And that was that feeling that something different was happening. And then, of course, Conan gets Dave's show and then kind of does Dave's show but puts a Simpsons cartoony spin on it.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, with Conan, with Dave, Dave was willing to did some very silly things in that show. Obviously, you know, he'd put on some of the outfits, you know, the legendary Alka-Seltzer and Velcro suit. But there's always a, you know, sort of a I don't want to say this in a negative way, but he always had this sort of cynical smirk about him.
Yeah. Well, you remember how much of that show was throwing things off roofs?
Throwing things off roofs. That was brilliant.
That's all there was. There was no punchline to it.
No, it was just, let's see what happens. You know, I hesitate to say it this way. In some ways, it's sort of like, you know, the original punk late night show.
Yeah, a little bit, but without this hyper aggression. I mean, it wasn't right. The Young Ones.
right. It was more cynical than aggressive.
Yeah, but it definitely had a DIY feel that punk had. It was like they knew they couldn't get the guests. They knew they didn't have the budget. They knew they didn't have the viewers.
Right.
But that's what made the CBS show so interesting, was how much of the 12:30 show he kept.
Yeah.
At 11:30, and you know, Conan tried to do that. Conan tried to keep his 12:30 show intact at 11:30, and they took it away from him.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and Conan was always more of a cartoon. Like I said, when you get describing it as very Simpsons-y, Conan himself is a cartoon character.
Well, there's a reason he does his hair that way.
Yes, exactly.
Like, you know, he looks like Tintin.
Exactly. So did you ever get to see the Letterman show live?
No, it was on standby once.
Okay.
And they not oversold because they were free tickets. I was online and, I did not get to go in. My cousin Johnny had a blind date there and went there.
Oh, wow.
And I've known stand-ups that did it. My cousin Eddie was a stage manager there, and they showed him during the end credits.
Oh, very cool.
So I have all these tangential connections with Letterman. Yeah. My biggest memory of Letterman was that the Improv was a block and a half away. So I would host the late night shows there all the time, and I'd be walking to the train at 2 a.m, and I would pass the Ed Sullivan Theater every night.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be dark, but I would look up at the marquee and I'm like, yeah, this is why you just did 2 hours in front of 6 people, 4 of which didn't speak English. Because the goal is this. And everybody who got to that goal did what I was doing.
Right.
So it was kind of this inspiration, but I loved it. And it was that rite of passage. What, as you were saying with the broken down TV, that was my experience as well, was in the summer during high school, when I didn't have to wake up and go to school, I watched Letterman every night.
Mm-hmm.
And I did watch it on a broken down black and white TV and then a broken down color TV.
Right.
And it was kind of this ritual. And there was something very personal about that show because it was dark and it was intimate and there were nobodies on it. That Letterman had that odd sensibility that he was talking just to you. You know?
It's very much so. And those times when he would go ahead and really get personal, I mean, it was, you know, about what he was feeling, was just some amazing TV.
Right, like when he had the heart attack or when he had to come out about the sex scandal.
Right. You know,
he was very upfront about it. And that was interesting about this last month, because, you know, he had all of his favorite guests back, mm-hmm. and they were all breaking down, and he was okay, you know?
Right.
He was just like, yeah, I'm leaving. That's it. And, you know, like, you know, Norm MacDonald is crying. Norm MacDonald is crying.
Yeah.
You know, because he did mean that much.
Right.
The people. Ray Romano came on and said, you know, you're the reason I have a career, because Worldwide Pants produced Everybody Loves Raymond.
That's right.
You know, it was reminding me of how beloved he was and how much of a power he was, which is why I said, you know what, we should probably talk about it this week.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because you're right. Millennials and the younger generation do see him the way we saw Carson.
Yes. Very much.
And with him leaving, we've seen a lot of people leave their late night shows recently. Craig Ferguson just left.
Mm-hmm. You know,
Jon Stewart just announced he's leaving. Colbert has left to take over David Letterman.
Right.
Conan was fired from The Tonight Show, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. So we have seen all of these people. Jimmy Fallon went from 12:30 to 11:30. We've seen all these people have their goodbye shows. But I haven't had this feeling since Carson retired.
Right. You know, and I think it's, you know, all of these, most of these shuffles are all because of Dave's decision to retire.
Yeah, well, and what created the late night wars was Dave not getting the Tonight Show and moving networks.
Exactly.
And that kind of broke the feeling that you had Carson at night and that was steady.
Right.
Like all of a sudden, late night was unsteady. I remember somebody saying at the time, why are we caring so much about a time slot that gets the least amount of viewers? And I think it's because we had been conditioned to, this was part of the nightly ritual.
Right.
So you didn't want things shaken up there because, you know, we played a little quieter, we played a little darker. You're expected to fall asleep to it.
And there's something very intimate about that, about it's, you know, a Letterman or a Carson. It's you know, when it's the last person you may hear talking to you at night as you fall asleep.
Right.
And that's a way that, you know, gets to you in a way that, that primetime doesn't.
Yeah, and we don't have that anymore because once there was competition, everybody got brighter and louder. So
right.
you're now watching a show.
Yes.
If you're, it doesn't matter who it is, if it's Jimmy Kimmel or Larry Wilmore or a Conan or Jimmy Fallon, everybody's putting on a show with primetime type energy.
Right.
And so you've lost that intimacy of like, hey, who's this guy? You know, oh, what's he talking about now? You know,
yeah.
And it was that, the fact that Letterman had anti-jokes. He had a lot of jokes where he just went, huh. You know, he would strap a camera to a monkey.
And see what happens.
Yeah. He would go down to, remember he used to torture Live at 5?
Oh, yeah. You'd show up on set or whatever. And also, I mean, he gave us BuzzFeed and Crack.com. He, you know, with
the top,
with
tens,
the,
yeah.
The top 10, you know, building out that format.
Right. And that, and yeah, that's something that was indelible where they did it early in the run of late night. It's one of the few things they carried over to CBS because it was so identifiable.
Right. And when they carried over, and there was talk that NBC wasn't going to let them.
Right.
Oh, there was that whole controversy over how much of the intellectual property would they be able to carry over.
Right, and there was a lot of stuff that did go away, but that was something that stayed.
Mm-hmm.
But there was something about it. And when he started on CBS, he had all this energy. I remember watching it with my roommate, and then we would tell the jokes the next day.
Right.
You know, there was, yeah, he, it was strange because he was never that warm a guy. He was never that. He never sold himself. He just basically stood. He was like a stand-up with ultimate confidence. He just said, "This is what I got. I don't care if you like it."
Right.
And that made people love him.
Yeah, and that's why they were able to connect. Why he was so good at connecting with people when, like you said, when he talked about the sex scandal, or when he talked about his heart surgery, or when the show came back after 9/11, or when you know, his eulogy, the way he eulogized Johnny Carson was just—it's just astounding. You know, there's just such that pure genuineness of him. You don't often see the emotions, but you know that what he's doing is a genuineness and a purity about it. That when he actually lets you see what's behind that, it just really connects in such a deeper way.
Yeah, yeah, because you didn't see it that often,
right?
Remember that there was that whole period after he had settled into CBS and he wasn't happy anymore. And I remember he would get drunk on the air a lot. I remember you would call me Because you were 3 hours ahead of me in Seattle.
Yeah.
And then you would call, you go, Dave's drunk tonight. And then I would watch it. And there was one time where he had Michael Rapaport on. And Michael Rapaport's, I think it was when he did the Woody Allen film, and he's trying to tell him about the film, and Dave is smearing shaving cream on his face.
or like the time he just took the fire extinguisher to Richard Simmons.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have no idea. I don't know anything about Charles Grodin's career. But anytime Charles Grodin was in that chair next to Letterman, they had just such an amazing rapport, and it was hysterical to watch that. You know, similar to the way he was with Regis. It's just that, you know, that faux hatred friendship thing going on. It was just that brilliant pattern they had and those relationships they had with key people.
Did you see the second to last episode of Letterman?
Yes, I did.
When Regis comes on and he's like, can I get on the last show? Book solid.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, man.
You know, I did actually get to see the show live once.
Did you? You went?
Yeah. This would have been probably 1998. The main guest was Anthony Edwards, mm-hmm. who was promoting ER at the time. And I want to say, I don't remember who the musical guest was, but he was a big name musical guest, and so that was very interesting experience. It was the second time I had been to that theater, because mm-hmm. the previous time I had been to that theater was probably about 5 years before. Well, no, it was probably about 10 years before that or so, for a taping of Kate and Ally.
They used to shoot Kate and Ally in there?
Yes, they did.
Because I could not remember what they did in that theater between the Ed Sullivan Show and Letterman, because it was not built for theater.
Right, right.
So they wouldn't have had Broadway musicals in there. Yeah. And Kate and Ally.
Kate and Ally. And I imagine there was probably another sitcom or two in there before they, you know, and after that. And then that break between when Kate and Ally ended and the Letterman show moved in, the theater just went to hell.
Oh, yeah. Well, Letterman talked about it on the last episode. Rats everywhere.
Rats everywhere.
And you know,
to be fair, that was Manhattan in the 80s.
Right. It was not Manhattan now, where you can't leave any amount of real estate not unturned.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And the rats are a little less aggressive now.
Yeah. So what was it like seeing Kate and Ally?
That was kind of an amazing thing. I really enjoyed the show at the time.
It was a decent show. Nobody remembers it anymore. It was Jane Curtin. And Susan St. James, and they were divorced women who shared a house and had kids, and that was enough to have a premise in the early 80s.
Yep, that was all it took. It was a fun show. It was a nice show. It was my introduction to Jane Curtin.
You hadn't seen Saturday Night Live at that point?
No, not at this point. I mean, the show started as I was probably sixth or seventh grade when the show first came on in the mid 80s. So I wasn't watching classic SNL yet. It was a fun show. It was my first time ever actually seeing any. Actually, it's still the only time I've actually seen a sitcom be taped. And, you know, you'd grown up at that point watching the bloopers show on TV. So you just keep hoping for some bloopers. And there are a couple of things they got to reshoot, like when one of the girls' sleeves gets caught on a stairway railing as they're walking down the stairs.
Oh, a stairway railing.
Yep. So they got to reshoot that. And, you know, just having the microphones in the audience to pick up the laughter. And so it was interesting to getting to see that process and then see how the sets are laid out on the stage. So there's the bedroom set. There's the main room set. There's, the different two or three other sets that are just ready to go.
Do you remember the Saturday Night Live sketch about Kate and Ally?
No, I don't.
It was Martin Short as Katharine Hepburn. And Billy Crystal as Muhammad Ali.
That sounds about right.
That's pretty much a Saturday Night Live sketch right there.
Mm-hmm.
It was enough to get 3 minutes out of it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then just sort of trail off.
So how was that? What was it like seeing Letterman?
It was, you know, it's something I'm very glad I did. I mean, the show, what you see on TV, that's pretty much what happened in the theater. In terms of you know, they had somebody do a little bit of warm up, and then Dave comes out for the crowd work because, you know, in the monologue, he always has that bit where he focuses on one guy in the audience.
Right.
Yeah, it turns out you think, yeah, he must have chatted with the audience a little bit, talk 5, 6, 7 people, pick up something, maybe pick the best, what's most. Nope. He just picked one person at random, talked to them, and they're like, okay, that's it. Crowd work was all of like 60 seconds.
It's one guy.
And then that's it. Then that's how you put together the show. You know, from the main level in the audience, your view is often blocked by a podium with a clock on it that they use to sort of, you know, keep track of the show. And so sort of like that guy, Craig Ferguson, always accused of being a racist, that guy. And that was sort of out in the middle of the floor. And yeah, it was pretty much, we were, from the time we sit down, it wasn't much more than an hour until the time we were released back onto Midtown.
Speaking of racism.
Okay.
This morning, the boys were watching Cookie Monster DVD.
Okay.
I'll let you sit there and figure out how I'm going to connect those two dots.
This is going to be... am I going to have to do paperwork about...
Not on this show.
So, I mean, crafting my Facebook apology.
There was a sketch where Cookie Monster was getting blamed for eating all the cookies, but he wasn't eating all the cookies.
Okay.
So he was getting frustrated.
Sure.
About being blamed. And it was like Gordon and Maria and Big Bird were all around him. And he's like, why do you think me eat cookies? And Big Bird.
Monster was being profiled.
He was. And Big Bird said, I swear to God, word for word, went, well, you are the Cookie Monster. And I yelled out, that racist. And the boys did not think it was funny. But Renee thought it was really funny.
Yep.
And so I've been walking around all day going, that racist. yeah, that was a stretch for that non sequitur. Yeah, I like I said, I never got a chance to see Letterman. I saw Jon Stewart.
Okay.
And that was fascinating.
How did that flow from an audience experience?
Oh, that was really interesting because Paul Provenza, I think it was Paul Provenza, did the warm up and he was really good. And he was kind of lounging all over the couch. This was still in the early 2000s when they had a couch, like before it was really panel heavy.
Right.
And then John came out and he did a little warm up beforehand. And then he was like, well, this is going to be the show. And then at the end, they did like some spots for Europe. And he said, well, you know, in Europe, we're once a week and we cut a bunch of clips together and then we do a hosting segment. So you guys are going to have to watch us do this hosting segment now. So I was fascinated by the upfrontness about it.
Uh-huh.
You know, and it does get to be just a job. You know, we've had Mike Brum on the show who talked about Colbert about like...
That was a fascinating interview.
Oh, thanks. But and he's just such a great guy that it becomes matter of fact after a while. But I love that, like, and that's what we're saying about Carson and Letterman. Like, even as a kid, I never believed in in glamour. You know, I've never cared about fashion.
Sure,
but like, you know, the glitz and the lights and oh, you wonderful people. Carson still had that because he came out of the Rat Pack era,
right?
And Letterman had none.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Which made him a great interviewer as well, because he didn't buy people's crap.
Right.
You know, and he would get into fights with people on the air.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and not in a political, you know, red versus blue, Fox News or Jon Stewart kind of way. Just like he would just tell people they were jerks sometimes. And sometimes people would tell him he was a jerk.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that was interesting, too, is that, you know, even when he had the politicians on or the various presidents, you know, yeah, he wasn't aggressively going after them, but he was questioning things.
Yeah.
He was still asking. He wasn't he was asking some, you know, it's like, you know, it's one of the things you've always got to watch out for is the guy who's very comfortable going, you know, I'm just a dumb guy, so let me just ask this.
And it was
the person who says that is usually probably a pretty sharp guy.
Yep. And Letterman always had that.
Yes.
And he tricked everybody into it because here he is dropping a watermelon off a roof. Here he is sending a guy in a bear suit into a strip club.
Right. Or seeing how many guys dressed up as the Easter Bunny they can get into a donut shop.
Yeah. My favorite, which I posted on the Caffeinated Comics page the night he ended, was how many Spider-Mans can fit in a Jamba Juice.
Right.
Just the words alone were great. And I found out my cousin Eddie, who is the stage manager, is the first Spider-Man in the Jamba Juice.
Well, that is excellent.
And that's all it is. It's 8 minutes long.
Yep.
Of like, all right, send in another Spider-Man. They're just standing around.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yep. You know, there's no payoff.
No.
It's not like, well, where does this go? Where it goes is another Spider-Man.
Another Spider-Man. It's, yeah, exactly. Until they get thrown out.
Yeah. Until they ran out of Spider-Mans and they're like, what else do we have at the costume shop? All right, send in a Dracula and a princess. And nothing happened. No one reacted.
Yep.
You know, other shows would have cut that.
Well, you know, and what's really cool about that is that that's sort of part of one of the things that was really nice about the show, and I think we saw more of this in the CBS show than the NBC, mm-hmm. is that a large part of the show is that it is a love letter to New York.
Yes.
And it is such a New York City. It's just such – this is why New York City is just an amazing place.
Yeah, and that's what and that's one of the things that – that I love so much about it was anytime I was in that neighborhood, I would walk by it.
Right.
You know, because the Hello Deli was really next door.
And it's really a deli.
Yeah. And when he would go out in that alley, that's the alley I used to walk home. And the Roseland was right over there with a big Roseland sign. That's gone now. They've torn that building down.
Right.
But yet, yeah, it was such a New York experience. I mean, the night before he ended, Bill Murray went out into the intersection and staged a protest.
Right.
And got people to do it.
Yep. They got to shut down Fifth Avenue in rush hour many times.
Yes. And they would shoot that show during rush hour.
Right, exactly.
It was like 5-6 at night.
You know, when we talk about some of the New York stuff that's in there and the institution that the show was, I mean, this last show, it was a really solid last show. The last 15 minutes are fantastic. I think in that respect, it's the opposite of the Craig Ferguson show, where the first 20 minutes of that last episode of Craig Ferguson were just absolutely brilliant. I, you know, for that opening montage, I can't even bring myself to delete it from my TiVo yet. But where Letterman's career, where I really feel his last show was actually in December when he did his last Christmas episode. Because he had done the same Christmas episode for the last 10, 15 years. It featured, Jay Thomas coming on to tell his story about the Lone Ranger. Featured Doreen Love singing her song at the end of the show. It featured, you know, them, you know, throwing footballs at the top of the Christmas tree to knock off the Pizza Empire State Building meatball combo that was on top of that. And it was just such an iconic and a really powerful thing to be watching that show, realizing that, you know, this is, yeah, it's a new show every year, but it's the same, it's essentially mostly the same lineup, the same theme, the same story, the same sad Christmas song at the end. And to just realize that's the last time he's going to shoot that show in his career.
Well, and that's why every guest who came on, they were all realizing this is the last time I'm going to be here. And it was all of his favorite people. I saw a supercut of Elvis Costello appearances. And uh-huh. I'm a huge Elvis Costello fan. And I was just reading his biography, so I was looking for clips on YouTube. And, you know, he's there on the NBC show with the attractions, and they go all the way up until, you know, a couple of months ago. And, you know, I don't think Elvis Costello ever even did panel with Dave, but he had him on like 20 times.
Right.
You know, if Dave likes somebody, and he said the reason the Foo Fighters played at the last show, which I thought was odd, Bob Dylan played the night before last.
Right.
So I figured there'd be somebody who at least went back further than Dave.
Yeah, exactly. Or at least more than, you know, half of his career.
Right. And Foo Fighters were formed after he had the CBS show.
Right.
But the story was after his heart attack, he was listening to Everlong over and over again. And then the Foo Fighters canceled a leg of their tour to do his first night back.
Yeah.
And he appreciates a gesture like that.
Yeah.
You know, but, and I always love that.
He starts choking up telling that story.
Yeah, and I always love just the little moments he took that just seemed genuine. Like, every time a band played on, Dave would always shake the hand of every member of that band.
Right.
You know, and you don't see that a lot. I love Conan, but usually Conan shakes the lead singer's hand and then waves to everybody else towards the audience.
Right.
Dave would just go, "Nice to see ya! How are ya?" Every person. And some of the Elvis Costello clips, some of those nights where he was solo and he would have some session guys behind him, not the attractions, Dave would shake all of those hands. Right. One time he had a choir and Dave shook the hand of everyone in the choir. You know, it was just, it was little genuine personable things like that.
Right.
That, like, you know, you can talk about how cranky he was, and God knows he was cranky.
And he did great cranky.
Yeah, and people said he was mercurial to work for. You didn't know what kind of mood you were going to get.
Right.
But that, it was the honesty of his persona would always peek through.
Yeah, and that's from the very beginning in the NBC show through the entire run of the CBS show. There is that core of honesty there, that core of, you know, just emotional honesty, of gratitude, and when he does something wrong, of regret, and just a really great example of what you can do.
Right. Yeah, because I go back to Conan's last speech on The Tonight Show, which was a great speech. But it covered the ground you thought it was going to cover of, like, I used to be this guy, and then I got this show, and it made me this guy, and I can't believe I've come this far. And Dave didn't do any of that. Dave showed clips of his failed morning show. Those were a lot of the clips he showed. He would show, like, one bit from the 90s, you know?
Right.
It wasn't this long montage. You showed him, you know, working at Taco Bell in Long Island. And I love that bit because he gets hung up on this little joke that's not a great joke.
Yeah.
But he loves it. But somebody pulls up and asks for 2-3 cheese melts.
Yeah.
And he never calls out that it's funny that it's 2 and 3.
Right.
He just kept saying, You want 3 cheese melts. 2-3 cheese melts.
Right.
And people drove away.
Yep.
Yeah, because again, that wouldn't happen in LA.
No, yeah, exactly. And you know, and at the same time, you know, doing something as humble as that to at the same time being able to be the guy who can get almost every living president to appear in a clip for his last show.
Right. Yeah, that's how it opened.
Yep.
Even presidents he didn't like. He was fairly critical of George W. But there he was. You know, but that's what I love about the contrast of Dave was that Dave was the biggest thing on late night. When he started CBS for that first year or so till Leno took over. And then when Leno left and he was still there, he was the biggest guy, but he never came off as a big showbiz force of nature, at least on screen.
Right. Well, I think what's really interesting, too, is that while Letterman often was never leading in the ratings, Leno almost always had higher ratings than Dave, but Dave was always the more significant show.
Yeah.
You would talk about more people would talk about the Letterman show than would talk about Leno, even though technically more people were watching Leno.
Right, because there wasn't as much to talk about.
Right.
Leno. You know, it was expected.
Yeah.
Leno was kind of doing a 90s version of what Johnny was doing.
Right, right.
Letterman was doing his own thing. And like I said, he might be in a bad mood that night. He might embarrass the guests. He might just do something crazy. That same show... with Michael Rappaport, I was saying with the shaving cream.
Uh-huh.
They had like, it was a stupid human trick or it was a bit, they had built a donut-apult.
I think I remember that.
Yeah, they had it for a couple weeks.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it does what you think it does. It launches donuts at people.
Right, exactly.
And after he smeared the shaving cream on my grandpa's face, he got up from his desk, walked over, and started working the donut occult again. Because he wanted to.
Because he wanted to, yep.
It's like a feeling that you get in radio when you know you're on every day and you know you're doing a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
As long as it's killing time.
You know, which during one of the writer's strikes some years back, that was when he first brought us even things like Hal Gurney's Network Time Killers.
Right.
This was during during one of the strikes in the 80s.
In the 80s, right. And then, yeah. And then the strike in 08, which was brilliant, where Jon Stewart, Colbert, and, I think that was Conan. Was that Conan at the time?
Yeah.
Yeah, Letterman wasn't involved, but they had to band together just to keep things going.
Right, exactly, exactly. Yeah.
Or when he had the heart attack, I remember that he had guest hosts for like a month.
Yep.
And they were really interesting, like Janine Garofalo and Bob and David, you know.
And Regis.
Regis, yeah, and they had, I remember that they had police tape around his desk, and they had elementary school desks, and the guest host would sit in that desk. You know, you don't make a big deal about it, but you do something original that calls it out.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I was choked up. And like I said, everybody, there wasn't a dry eye in the house that night except for Letterman. And all he did in his last speech, he didn't talk about his own career. He didn't talk about his experiences. He talked about everyone else.
About the staff and the band. And,
right.
You know, it was the one sort of genuine conversation he ever had with Alan Coulter.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating. And there was a great article in the New York Times about that, too. Of like, yeah, what am I doing? You know?
Mm-hmm.
Just little things he would add about, like, he was just looking at it like a guy that had worked the same job for 30 years. And we don't really have that anymore.
Right.
You know, right. That used to be in the time of the baby boom, the post-war era. We talked about it on the show before. You graduated college. You got a job, you got promoted several times, and then you retired from that company.
Yep.
And Dave's a guy who changed jobs once in 30 years. And he had that attitude of like he was getting the gold watch.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Retire out to his ranch in Montana.
Yeah. And I think maybe that's another thing we're losing is that, you know, certainly you or I don't feel that we're going to, you know, work somewhere for decades.
No, and the idea of it, you know, whether or not we would have a choice even is beyond it, you know, because it's, why would I want to do that?
Right. Yeah, what am I missing out on? You know, I know people that have been at a job for 6-7 years and they go, why am I still here?
Right.
You know, am I holding my career back by not moving? And Dave comes from that different era where it was that kind of stability.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what made the late night war so crazy.
Right.
Was that he was a guy who was just, he just stayed and stayed and stayed and stayed, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with Conan, you had Andy Richter leave, do a bunch of pilots.
Yep.
You know, bounce around for 10 years, do a bunch of pilots and a couple of shows that got canceled after one season and then come back.
Right.
And that's like, that's more our speed, which...
Well, I mean, even Conan's band leader, he was just, I mean, joining the Conan show for all that time, that was essentially a part-time gig to kill time between Springsteen tours.
Yeah, he would leave for 6 months at a time, anytime Springsteen would tour. And then when he went to the Tonight Show, Max was like, nah, I don't want to move to L.A. And then he left.
Yep.
Yeah, and that was the feeling between Dave and Conan, was that it was kind of like, growing up, I felt like Carson was my dad's late night host.
Mm-hmm.
Letterman was my uncle's late night host.
Okay.
But Conan was ours. And I remember this feeling when Conan started was like, he's 10 years older than us. But it was this feeling of like our generation has a talk show now.
Right.
You know, in the same way that you know, Jimmy Fallon's closer to our age than Conan is. But Fallon feels like, okay, the millennials now have their host.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know, and these guys are generational, and I don't know if we can continue to say that.
Well, that's going to be the very interesting question about how long, you know, how long will Jimmy Fallon have his show? Will, I mean, he's coming up on 5 years now, isn't he?
Not on the Tonight Show. He did 5 years at he did 5 years at the 12:30 show. He's on about two.
Yeah.
We talked to Mike Drucker last year, and that was during Fallon's first year.
Right. Okay.
So he's only been at it for a couple of years.
So it becomes a question of will we or somebody else be talking about Fallon this way in another 15, 25, 20, 25 years?
We might. You know what throws the timeline off is that Conan was on TBS around like 2011, but they didn't give it to Fallon. Leno came back.
That's right. That's right.
And we had to wait for Leno to decide he was done.
Right. Exactly.
After he decided he was done the first time.
And by the way, that was the thing that was most disappointing about Craig Ferguson's last show, that he spends the whole time talking to freaking Jay Leno.
Jay Leno was on Craig Ferguson?
Yep, he was the only guest for the last show.
Yeah, they kept asking Dave if Jay Leno was going to come on the show, and he was like, yeah, I don't think so. Yeah,
they did show a couple of photos of Leno.
Yeah, you know, I could show photos of Leno.
Yeah.
that doesn't mean I have his approval.
Yeah, and the clip from the Super Bowl commercial that he and Jay did with Oprah.
With Oprah, right, yeah. Yeah, that was... It's interesting. I mean, and what kind of shook me was in the midst of all this getting ready, like Jon Stewart announces he's leaving, and which we talked about the last time you were on, but then everyone under him started leaving. You know, Samantha Bee is getting her own talk show.
Mm-hmm.
On TBS. She's getting the show after Conan. And like a lot of the consultants on there are moving on. It's like, I feel like we're in a big sea change.
Right.
In this era.
Yeah, and there's so much more opportunity for folks. Folks have had the chance to really study under some of these just brilliant teachers. Mm-hmm. And now trying their own and trying to branch out and do things that, you know, weren't possible 5-10 years ago, thanks to, you know, due to technology and due to just the changing cultural shift, which allows you to start looking at some more of these things, more of these opportunities.
Yeah, and generational. I mean, people are saying now that John Oliver is doing a better job than Jon Stewart was.
Right.
Well, I think Last Week Tonight is brilliant. I started DVRing it. And The Daily Show and Colbert and, to a greater extent, Letterman and Conan were all shows that if I was home and they had a guest I like, I would watch.
Mm-hmm.
But John Oliver, being once a week, is giving him time to refine the material, to dig deeper into research, and it's becoming more of a destination.
Right, right. Well, you know, just the nature of it is, as a weekly show, it just naturally becomes more of an event than a daily show.
Right. Yeah, it's not a constant. You're waiting for it. And HBO has always been good at that weekly wrap-up show ever since Not Necessarily the News. But, you know, Chris Rock had that show for a while. Dennis Miller had that show. Bill Maher still does a show then. Yeah. Yeah, it is an interesting time. And it's a reminder of how generational this is. And a lot of people are taking this to be like, well, if Letterman's leaving, where does that leave me?
Right, exactly. I mean, Craig's retirement decision was in part driven just because Letterman retired, so that tied into his contract because he was Worldwide Pants.
Right, and you know what? CBS might as well just start a clean slate. Have you seen James Corden?
I haven't yet. I really do need to take the time to watch some of that and just see if I can see him as something other than Craig is father of Stormageddon.
Yeah, two episodes of Doctor Who. Every time I see James Corden, I'm like, I don't know if I buy him as a talk show host. You've seen him on two episodes of Doctor Who. He had a show on the BBC. You didn't watch it. But he is. There's serious growing pains. But then again, Conan had serious growing pains.
Conan was rough. And
yeah, it's a type of show you have to grow into.
Right. Yeah. You have to discover what the show is.
Right.
You know, I mean, when Craig left such a mark on that show. I mean, and such a different show than the one that he took over.
Right, the Craig Kilborn show.
Craig Kilborn show, which was awful.
It was, and he left The Daily Show to do that show.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And that's like, I've never heard good things about Craig Kilborn. Well, no, I met one writer that liked him. But,
except that he can drive down a show so bad that the next person who takes it over is going to become an iconic superstar about it.
Right. And yeah, well, and twice.
Yeah.
Jon Stewart essentially created The Daily Show, but Craig Kilborn had been doing it for 2 years.
Right.
And the same thing. Craig Ferguson took over a show that Craig Kilborn did for about 2 years. And when was the last time you saw Craig Kilborn?
Yeah, at the end of his time on the Late Late Show.
Yeah, 10 years ago.
Yep.
Yeah, it's amazing. I remember that when Carson was leaving. Remember there was a flood of bad late night talk shows.
Oh sure, that's when Pat Sajak had his show.
Yeah, and Chevy Chase. Yep, Magic Johnson. I remember there was one. UPN had one, and I think you and I watched it once. I don't remember who the guy was, but it was called Johnny B. on the Loose. And it looked like they just found some radio guy. And you can see these guys that just get in way over their head. There was a period of Joan Rivers' show after her
She went right up against Carson.
She went right up against Carson, but when she ended, she was canceled, but they kept the show going. It became Arsenio.
Oh, okay.
And then Arsenio started as Joan's replacement and then realized he could like make a lot more money in syndication and created another show that he could own because he couldn't own Joan Rivers' show. And there was a weird period of about a year where they were just letting anybody host that damn thing. I think until it became Chevy Chase.
Who put the nail in the coffin?
Yeah. Well, no, I think Magic Johnson came after Chevy Chase. Magic Johnson was fascinating because he couldn't tell a joke. But you start to see how hard these shows are when you see people fail at them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Pat Sajak, Thick of the Night.
Thick of the Night, yeah.
Yeah, David.
You know, out of that era, though, the one that does not get nearly the credit it deserves was the Bob Costas show.
Oh, yeah, but he was doing Tom Snyder.
He was doing Tom Snyder. And Tom Snyder, because Tom Snyder went away, Bob Costas came up, did a Tom Snyder type show, which was just brilliant. And then Tom Snyder ultimately came back to do the Late Late Show.
I loved that before Craig Kilborn and
Patrick Rich. He was just nuts.
Yeah, that's why I loved it.
That show was such an amazing train wreck. It was fantastic.
Yeah, I couldn't stop watching it. I watched that religiously from like 96 to 98. I waited for Dave to end because he would just ramble. I would write these Tom Snyder monologues, and we wrote a sketch, which was in our feature screenplay that no one could ever shoot. There was a sketch of Bill Cosby as the guest on Tom Snyder. And they were both just trying to out-abstract each other in terms of words. Like, I would just write these Tom Snyder stories that went nowhere. And then Bill Cosby would tell a story that would devolve into sound effects. And it was like 8 pages of that.
You know, if you were ever going to rewrite that, you'd have to do it with Avery Brooks.
Yeah. Well, you couldn't use Bill Cosby number one anymore. Yeah, Avery Brooks talking to William Shatner was a lot like
the satire you wrote.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, we can't go one episode without you bring up Shatner's Raw Nerve, which was a talk show so bad, they decided the premise of it was to make the guest uncomfortable.
Yes.
There's no way they pitched it like that.
No.
There's no way they pitched it as a show of William Shatner makes people uncomfortable, because how would they book it?
Well, you know, and how could they not see that that's what it was going to be? I mean, they used the love toilet from that old Victoria Jackson Saturday Night Live bit.
They did.
That was the couch in the
They room. Couldn't look at each other, and the camera angles couldn't get either one of them at all. What was that on? Trio?
Lifetime. It was Lifetime, I
IFC? It was it was very it wasn't like, and he was like, it's the raw nerve. I'm going to ask the questions that no one's going to ask. I was just like, no, you're just going to have a conversation that dies every 45 seconds.
Yeah, exactly.
And there was just always this look on the guest face of like, what is going on here? I never had Jimmy Kimmel on. He was like, really, what is going on here?
Like, do you really want Shatner to be your psychologist?
No, Shatner's not interested in other people. Yeah, so I think all of these shows that we're talking about just underscores how great late night was.
Right.
And
how through all that's changed over the last 35 years that Dave had a show, how much of the core of who he is and what his show is from some of the, you know, just the nature of his attitude, the way he treated folks, to even the bits like the top 10 and just the way he interacted with going out in the public in New York. I mean, how much of that stayed the same and constant over the decades?
Right. Yeah. I think that's where we come back to. This is why I like talking to you, because I feel like between the two of us, we figure out what the theme of the conversation is.
By the end of it.
Yeah. And how do people follow you online?
They can follow me at Cromley.net or on Twitter at Cromley.
You can follow me at Not In My Book on Twitter. That is the Caffeinated Comics Twitter feed. Like us on Facebook. A lot of things going on Facebook. And Steven's shop is 19 South LaGrange Road in LaGrange, Illinois. We will talk to you next week.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not In My Book production.
Thank you!